Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book, Get What's Yours for Medicare. Maximize your coverage, minimize your costs. And it's kind of a perfect day for it because Medicare enrollment begins today. Author Philip Mueller is with us. He's an award-winning journalist. He also writes the Ask Phil feature for PBS NewsHour. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions about signing up for Medicare? What issues have you had? I'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Philip Mueller, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure.
How did you get into the business of helping people with things like Medicare and Social Security?
I think I was dropped on my head at a young age. I've been writing. I got my first newspaper gig 50 years ago. I've been pretty much working ever since. I started to specialize in what I call explanatory consumer journalism. A number of years ago, I did like nearly 1,000 articles for U.S. News World Report. I ended up answering lots and lots of questions. And then about a decade ago, two guys got in touch with me and said, hey, we're thinking of doing a book on Social Security. Would you like to help us? Again, I'm not necessarily the highest wattage bulb, but I said, okay. And we did this book explaining how the program worked, and people bought it, and then they bought it some more, and they bought so many that it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 months. So from there, I said, you know, well, Social Security is really important, but Medicare is the second foundational block of a successful retirement, and the programs actually work closely together. So, in 2016, I wrote a book on Medicare, and it sold a lot of copies. And a couple of years ago, I went to my publishers and I said, listen, Medicare is totally different than what it was 8 years ago, so let's do a revised book. And that came out last week. It's time for open enrollment. And I want to make one slight adjustment to what you said. You know, every year, 3 to 4 million Americans turn 65 and sort of age into Medicare. But open enrollment, annual enrollment, is for the people who already have Medicare, and there are 70 million of those. So those 70 million people have decisions to make, and hopefully maybe a few of them will ask you questions today.
Well, I tell you what, there, I've read your book, and it is... You, in a very clear fashion, you straighten out so much about what Medicare does and what Medicare can be for people. But I, you know, a lot of friends of mine have said, "What? It's confusing. Why does it seem so confusing?"
This is an opinionated answer. It seems so confusing because the private health plans that provide Part D drug coverage and Medicare Advantage coverage, they make it seem confusing. It's in their interest for it to be confusing, because if something's confusing, then you need to pay attention to the expert, and we're here for you. We're going to help you wade through this, et cetera. My position is that it doesn't need to be that confusing. And so I try to explain in my books sort of the basic pathways. Here's the kinds of Medicare you can choose from. Here's how to find out what they are. Here's how to figure out which kind of package is the best for you. Here's how to figure out what it costs. All that information is easily available. But people have to overcome the sense of, oh, my goodness, I'm a deer in the headlights. I can't make these decisions. But that's doing themselves a disservice. they can make these decisions. And I would argue that this annual enrollment season, when plans for 2025 must be selected, is an unusually important season. This is not Medicare business as usual. There are some big changes that people may encounter in their coverage for next year. And people can just buy my book and read all about it. But the point is, I'd be happy to answer any specific questions and drill down a little bit into why next year is going to be an important year.
Yeah. What influences the changes we see in Medicare?
There are several things. Most importantly, are the sets of government rules that influence the design of the various packages of Medicare, the prices that they charge. And in particular, in 2022, the Biden administration pushed through what's called the Inflation Reduction Act. And one of the major provisions of this act was significant changes in Medicare's drug rules, including price caps on out-of-pocket expenses, which is a big deal, $35 cap on insulin prices, which is a big deal, and for the first time, authorizing Medicare to negotiate the prices of drugs with drug manufacturers. When Part D plans were created 20 years ago, in, I might say, a Republican administration, the law specifically excluded Medicare from negotiating prices for drugs. Well, Medicare is the 800-pound gorilla of healthcare. They have a dominant role in healthcare. They are extremely influential. And had they been allowed to negotiate drug prices 20 years ago, there's no doubt in my mind that we'd be paying a lot less for drugs. So Medicare is sort of tippy-toeing its way into this and authorized 10 expensive drugs to be negotiated. Those negotiations have already occurred. The new prices have been announced, but they won't take effect until 2026. And we wouldn't want to rush these things. But in addition, the law authorizes Medicare to negotiate three more rounds with drug companies. So by the time the dust clears in 4 or 5 years, we'll have at least 40 drugs subject to price negotiation. If Kamala Harris wins the White House, she has pledged to open up more drugs for price negotiation and expects to use savings from those negotiations to provide other consumer benefits in healthcare.
Wow. Our guest, Philip Moeller's book is titled Get What's Yours for Medicare, Maximize Your Coverage, Minimize Your Costs. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. You know what? I liked right off the bat in your book, by the way, you have a user's guide. Part A, Part B, Part C, Part D, which makes for a handy reference. And I got a kick out of the fact that you say, authors don't recommend tearing up books, but feel free to cut out this user's guide. And it is extremely helpful as you go through the book.
I do say you're supposed to cut it out neatly, Larry, that no messy tears here, because I value my work. But these things, you need to repeatedly sort of be exposed to them and think about them. And, I guess it's logical for Medicare to call these parts A, B, C, and D, but it's an alphabet soup that some people, just a major eye glaze factor. And so, yeah, cut out the little, it's only 2 pages, right? 1 page of newsprint. Just cut it out and use it as a bookmark.
Yeah, I found it interesting. I found it useful. To be able to refer back some, you can get lost. You make things very clear, but it's, I forget things from time to time, like what was part B and what was part D? So I really
Yeah, my writing's like Chinese food. It tastes really good, but you're hungry 3 minutes later. Like, what is it I ate? What, I need something more. So it's hard to retain this stuff. We only remember things that we either really want to learn about or that we have to learn a lot about. And if people don't feel that way about Medicare, they're probably not interested in learning a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the factors, and this is going to be kind of an individualized, assume, thing, but how can you choose what's the best route for you? What kinds of factors do you consider?
I consider a number of factors. First of all, what's your financial situation? How much disposable income do you have to devote to your health care insurance? Secondly, I think about people should think about their health. And I urge people to do their insurance planning based on a portrait of their future self, not their current self. I'm 78 years young, and I can tell you that I'm not as healthy as I was last year. I probably won't be as healthy next year as I am this year. It is the nature of the joy of aging that we have a lot of physical challenges. So having said that, the third test I do, which is the most important one for me, is what I call the head on the pillow test. When you go to bed at night and you think about, oh, what do I regret? What do I need to pay attention to? I don't like my health care to be among those. So there are different packages of Medicare. You can get traditional Medicare, which is original Medicare, which is Part A for hospital, Part B for outpatient doctor's expenses. And you can also get with that what's called a Medigap supplement plan, because as it turns out, Larry, Medicare, basic Medicare, doesn't pay 100% of all the things it covers. The biggest gap in original Medicare is it only pays 80% of your doctor bills and your outpatient expenses. Medigap supplement plans can close much, and in some cases, just about all of that gap. Surprise, they're expensive. In contrast, but if you get that package, you pretty much you have very few healthcare spending surprises. On the other hand, you can get a private Medicare Advantage plan. They are designed and sold by private insurance companies. They're not overseen directly by the government. They are much, much cheaper. There are lots of reasons for that, but the bottom line is you will pay less for Medicare Advantage plan. You also will get coverage for things like routine hearing, dental, and vision coverage that original Medicare is by law not allowed to cover. Now, the dollar value of these supplemental benefits isn't huge, but they really make these plans attractive, and they're a major reason why people with Medicare Advantage plans now comprise more than half of all those 70 million enrollees. So the downside of Medicare Advantage, because nothing's for free, is that you have to use a network of doctors and other healthcare providers that has been set up by your plan. Original Medicare lets you use any doctor in the country that accepts Medicare, and most people do. Medicare Advantage usually restricts your care to the network that it provides, and that care is often only available in the immediate geographic area where you live. So some Medicare Advantage plans don't travel well for that reason. If you go on, you know, if you live in warm weather climate in the winter and you go back to your old home grounds in the summer, you might have trouble getting good coverage in those two markets. So there are pluses and minuses of both. Again, traditional Medicare with a Medigap plan, better coverage, more expensive. Medicare Advantage plan, less expensive, limited geographic coverage perhaps, but coverage of these supplemental benefits that people love.
Phil,
those are the two main pathways.
Yeah, Philip Moeller, our guest today, his book, Get What's Yours for Medicare. And you can join in. We have a number of callers online, and we'll get to Dave and Jeannie and Maya in just a minute. But a reminder, I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Taking a look today at the revised and updated Get What's Yours for Medicare. It's written by Philip Moeller, and it is full of great information about how you can get what's yours for Medicare. And Dave in Marshfield has a question, so we'll go there now. Dave, thank you for calling.
Well, yes, and thank you for having this youngster of a guest on that knows his stuff. I've got him by a year, and I'm healthier this year than I was last. And expect to be healthier than this next year. But my question, back in about 2017, I dropped my Part D coverage and took up Wisconsin, it's Badger Care. So that Badger Care, which was only $30 a year, it accounts for or takes care of having a drug coverage so that I won't have to end up paying a penalty. I do not take any prescription drugs. And so I thought this was a pretty good deal. That may have changed. When I did this, my understanding was if something changed in my health, like if I was diagnosed with cancer or something, that I would be able to change that drug coverage and pick up the Part D. So that's my question. That's my comment. You know, that worked.
Yeah, I'm not expert in the local program that you've been using. I suppose there's a chance they have an agreement with Medicare, but that would be unusual in my experience. I mean, the rules for Part D are you don't have to get it, but if you're eligible for it and you don't get it, then the clock starts ticking on a penalty. Now, the Part D penalties aren't huge. They are 1%. They average about 30 to 35 cents a month for every month you're sort of late in enrolling. So if you were like, I don't know, round out the numbers, 8 years late, let's just say that you had 100 months of late enrollment. So you'd be paying an extra $30 a month for your Part D coverage for the rest of your life or as long as you had Part D. Now, $30 is not free, but it's pretty – it's not that burdensome if your alternative is to have to pay thousands of dollars for a drug. Let me mention one other thing, though. Drugs that are given on an outpatient basis, which is where most cancer drugs are infused, they're not covered by Part D. They're covered by Part B, as in boy. B covers outpatient expenses, including drugs that are administered by a clinician in an outpatient setting. So just to make sure you're aware of that distinction.
Really good information. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Jeannie in Wausau. Jeannie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. You always have wonderful guests. And I love your phrase that you always use. I read your book, you know, so you always ask informed questions. But the facts are I am 73, retired from full-time employment in April, have coverage of Medicare Part D through COBRA, which will end after 15 months, you know, and I'm paying for that. And I was in a profession where I had to answer questions about people's eligibility for public assistance and benefits and so forth. And my question really is, isn't traditional Medicare enough? And, you know, the Part D and trying to stay healthy, you know, that is on people and they should try to stay healthy. And then all of us, you know, it'll all turn on a dime. You know, I could be in an accident tomorrow and all my needs would change and medical coverage would change. But what I read about a lot are these problems with limited coverage and choice of doctors and contracts changing. And that throws people's, you know, medical plans into, you know, chaos.
Yeah. Kind of the Advantage Plan side of things I think you're talking about there, Jeannie. Anyway, Phil, a comment.
Well, you know, that goes back to my head and the pillow test. You know, you want to make sure that you don't have surprises. If you can afford it, traditional Medicare with a Medigap supplement plan is the most complete, flexible coverage you can get. But it is more expensive. It can cost you at least a few thousand dollars more a year than a Medicare Advantage plan. You know, but the downsides are what you mentioned in the call. Let me just take a step back, though, and say Medicare Advantage plans are a experiment in motion. When the government sets up these rules, I'm sure you'd be shocked that it doesn't know exactly how things are going to play out. It tries to create a fair set of rules, and then it sort of looks at, see, well, how do people respond? How does the market respond? And Medicare Advantage plans have had a lot of bumps in the road. They do have over-aggressive sales tactics. They historically have denied coverage for claims that turn out to have been very appropriate medically. So the government's sort of, they're toughening up oversight of these plans in response to these concerns. And I expect the plans to get better. I don't expect them to get better fast enough to meet the needs of some people who would rather have traditional Medicare. But the big change in Medicare that we have to figure out how to grapple with is that traditional Medicare is great, but it's called fee-for-service care, which means it doesn't have very many regulatory guardrails. If something's covered by traditional Medicare, you can ask for that, and your claim's going to be approved. And I will tell a story on myself because I'm the person who can do that. I needed a new shoulder last year, which I not the most fun experience I've had. But in order to make sure that I found a good surgeon, I made consulting appointments with three different doctors. I went to three different appointments. They all took pictures. They all had fees, et cetera, et cetera. Traditional Medicare, which I have, pay for every one of those three appointments. I can't argue that I needed all three appointments. It was mostly for peace of mind and making sure I made a good choice. If I had a Medicare Advantage plan, I don't know that it would have paid for more than a single appointment. Would my health have suffered? I don't know. But fee-for-service Medicare tends to encourage overuse of health care. It turns out that this country has a lot of unneeded and low-value health care that doesn't make us better. It costs money. And in some cases, it can make us worse because it creates treatment recommendations for things you don't need, and they sort of trigger their own sets of physical and sometimes emotional problems if you think you need to be cared for something. So it's a tough transition, though. The government doesn't get it right on the first try, but it does keep trying. Yeah, I don't think we're going to move away from this movement towards what's called managed health care, which is what Medicare Advantage plans offer. Nobody likes to be told what to do, particularly in health care. So the idea of having your healthcare managed by a third party, that doesn't sit well with people from day one. And that's a struggle that people have dealing with Medicare Advantage, as your caller mentioned. I mean, there are problems with these plans.
Phil, great answer. Thank you so much, Jeannie, for calling. Irene in Phillips, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Irene.
Hi. Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I was outside and came in and heard a man talking about not needing many prescriptions or any prescriptions. And I'm in the same boat, and I have Security Health Plan, AdvoCare. I don't pay for Part D. I have senior care in Wisconsin, which is $30 a year, and that can be switched over to Part D if necessary. I just wanted to make that comment, okay?
All right. Thank you for calling. And as Phil, as you were saying, there's going to be an added cost if you don't accept it right away. But that cost, the example you used with, I think, 100 months or whatever, was about $30 in the case of the earlier caller.
Right. It basically, you know, the penalty for late enrollment in Part D is based on a national standard average for drug prices, which has been about $35 a month for a premium. So you're basically taking 1% of that every month. So it's at 35 cents a month. And you multiply it by the number of months you're late. So in some cases, it is a mathematical decision. I had a very good friend of mine who is pretty well off, who said, I'm going to self-insure my drug needs. I don't take many drugs. And then after he'd been eligible for Medicare for 6 or 7 years, he said, he had some health challenges. And he said, you know, these expensive drugs can even dent my budget. So he finally decided to sign up late, paid the penalty, and then moved ahead.
Yeah. All right. Irene, thanks again. Harlan in Barron, Wisconsin, your turn.
Yes, I would say that Medicare, most people don't realize that Medicare Advantage plans are not only inadequate, insufficient or absent, they are actually criminal. The companies are stealing from both you and the government. I know what I'm talking about because it happened to me. You're given coverage for major illnesses, which is incomplete, insufficient or absent, and then the government pays them $1,000 a month to do that. Now, if you really get sick like I did, you're going to be paying for those $2.
We lost him. Well, Phil,
and he was on a roll too, Larry.
Yeah, I'm sorry we lost him. Comments on his comments.
Let me just say that by law, Medicare Advantage plans are supposed to cover every health need that traditional Medicare covers. So in reality, what happens is that they, because they're managed health care, they usually subject your desire for care to what's called prior authorization. In other words, they review your request before they allow the care to continue. In many cases, some plans have been way too aggressive in denying care. As I said earlier, care that it later turned out was entirely appropriate. I think that must have happened to your caller. Now, as to the second thing, there is no doubt that Medicare Advantage plans have sort of gamed the system and figured out a way to use their reimbursement rules with Medicare to increase their payments from the government. They do this, the simplest way to put it is, they create a profile of each enrollee or patient, and they are allowed to tell the government sort of how sick this patient is, and they use appropriately legal means to make their patient population appear sicker than it is. Patients may never know this. the patient's doctors may never notice, but the plans collect more money from the government than is needed. And the government oversight unit called the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which is the congressional watchdog, estimated that in this year alone, these plans will get $80 billion that they really didn't earn.
Wow.
And that money, by the way, comes straight out of the Treasury. There's no program that we have to fund that. There's not like a trust fund for these kinds of Medicare expenses. So it comes straight out. It's a blank check on the Treasury. And so when you look at government deficits, you can chalk, you know, and we have huge deficits. And so $80 billion, unfortunately, doesn't change the tendency of deficits, but it's a big number.
Yeah, I guess so. Harlan, thank you again for your comment. I'm sorry we lost you. Casey in southern Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Casey.
Hi. I want to comment on the Medicare, this discussion that's been going on. I agree with the prescription plan because I pay $30 for that too. But I also pay $25 or $50, depending on which one I choose, to have a Medicare prescription plan through my Pick and Save or a pharmacy like Walgreens or some of the private ones as well for an additional amount of money. Neither one of these cover, though, the higher cost drug that would help me right now as far as heart disease. So there's more discussion that could happen just around the prescription plan. Pick and Save is especially good. My real question is, what do people do who are wealthier, who've had jobs in a company, maybe are up the ladder towards being a CEO or something like that? What do they do about a plan? Are they using Medicare as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, generally, the answer is yes, they are. Medicare is a very good health insurance program, and it can be cost effective even for people who made a lot of money. What's going to change, though, is that if you are very wealthy and you have a health issue, the United States is probably the best country in the world to live in because you can private pay to get care at an MD Anderson in Texas or a Cleveland Clinic in Ohio or a Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and or a Hopkins in Baltimore. You can go to the absolute best healthcare providers and you can augment whatever Medicare pays, you know, will pay you with whatever it is you need to use. And many of the most sought-after medical professionals in this country, they don't accept Medicare because they don't have to. Their practices are full of what's called private pay patients. And those patients can afford the very best care. And so they probably get better care than you and I do. They pay a lot of money for it. I would say, other than sort of that 1% or whatever percentage you want to use, I think traditional Medicare with the Medigap plan provides very effective coverage. My wife and I, unfortunately, have substantial health needs, including, I alluded earlier, I had a shoulder operation. My shoulder operation bills at $300,000. This stuff is really expensive. But I didn't pay a penny out of pocket for my shoulder, not a penny. It was all covered by traditional Medicare, and the Medigap plan paid for the portion of the surgery that Medicare didn't pay for. I have what's called a letter G Medigap plan, which is the most comprehensive plan that people can get who are new to Medicare right now. That plan cost me about, I want to say, $2,600 a year. For me, it's a bargain.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Casey, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kathleen in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, well, I was responding to a gentleman who called in earlier about being on Badger Care and coming off and whether what his availability was to get into a drug plant. And we have Badger Care here, and we also in Wisconsin have a program called Silver Strip, which is incredibly inexpensive, doesn't cover very much, but it means you don't have to buy a plan, and when you're ready to go on the plans, you can do so without any penalty. In both cases, when this gentleman, if he comes off of Badger Care or if he was on Silver Script, he has a period of time, I don't remember, it's 30, 60, 90 days, whatever, to get into a new plan and do that without being penalized for not having been on a prescription drug plan for however many years he was on his other plan. But so I just wanted to answer that because that's a really important thing for him. He has a time deadline when he comes off of the state plan he's on to get into a prescription drug plan without paying the penalty.
Let me just ask the caller a question. From my knowledge, Silver Scripts is a Part D drug plan provided by a unit of Aetna. I have a Silver Scripts plan. I can't believe that you could use that name in trade without it being part of an Aetna Part D plan. But Silver Scripts is a very low premium plan. And if you don't take a lot of drugs, you really don't pay much more than the premium and whatever the annual deductible is. So is it possible that actually you've had a Part D plan for some time?
Yeah.
Okay. So no, so what I'm sorry, I misspoke. The state plan, not the Badger Care plan, but there is a separate plan run by the state of Wisconsin that is available to anybody and it's not income related. And I'm blanking on the name of it now, but both Badger Care and that state-run drug plan, you can come off of without being penalized.
Understood. So, Larry, you know, my user guide to the book, can you imagine how long it would be if I have to include all the state programs? But the caller makes a good general point. There can be wrinkles in the general advice I give based on where you live.
Yeah.
So one thing to this is a good segue for me. There is a free service of Medicare advice that's called the State Health Insurance Assistance Program. It's funded by the federal government. It's staffed by trained volunteers, and they have offices in every state in the country. So if you're in Wisconsin, you go on the internet, you Google this program, the initials are SHIP, and you find a local office, you can call them, you can email them. My hope is that they would be familiar with the Wisconsin rules. They could give you good informed advice on the transitional issues you faced that we've been talking about.
Yeah. Very good points, Phil. Thank you, Kathleen, as well. Phil Moeller, our guest today, he's got a revised and updated version of Get What's Yours for Medicare. Maximize your coverage, minimize your costs. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today as we take a look at the book, revised and updated book, Get What's Yours for Medicare, Maximize Your Coverage, Minimize Your Costs. Our guest, the author, Philip Moeller, and he's done a wonderful job in the book and also today answering your questions. And lots of questions for you, Phil. So let's go to Anthony in Milwaukee. Thank you for calling, Anthony. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm in the VA system, Larry, and I'm wondering what changes I have to make when I come up on Medicare age in a couple of years.
Okay, we got it. Go ahead.
It's going to depend on your needs. Again, same issues. You don't necessarily have to get a Medicare Part B, as in boy plan. BA coverage, if you have liked your care in the VA system, you don't have to change it. The VA system is especially good with drugs. And so Part D plans don't necessarily provide you an improvement for the coverage you already get in the VA. The big issue is if you get a Part B, as in boy, Medicare plan, you pay a monthly premium, but you have a lot more freedom of where you find your doctors. So the question is, as you may know, that the VA has had some real capacity issues and that it can't provide within its own network the volume of care that our veterans demand and need. So there's often a stress, and this is not a national problem. It tends to be a regional problem. It depends where you live. So if I were you and I was happy as a clam with my current coverage, I would sit tight. If you later decide to get Part B, you will pay a late enrollment penalty, and which is somewhat steeper than the penalty for the drug plans that I've been talking about during the hour. That's your choice, but you are not legally required to get Part B.
Anthony, thank you for calling. A listener emailed us. They'll be retiring next year as well, kind of like Anthony, and currently they use quartz. When do they need to enroll in Medicare B? Will their two teenage kids be covered? And Quartz is, believe, University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics is their service provided right through them. Yeah.
Again, not an expert on Quartz. However, Medicare is an individual coverage program. It doesn't cover couples. It doesn't cover families. So the odds are if this person is going to sort of age into Medicare, then their kids, and they're going to lose employer coverage, then their kids probably have to get on an Affordable Care Act policy in Wisconsin.
Got it. Mary in Verona, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I have a question about delaying Medicare. I would still qualify to be covered by medical insurance through my husband's employer. And also, I suspect that because of income and that, I would be subject to the IRMA. So I'm wondering how you delay Medicare and if that's, you know, an advantageous consideration for me to remain on his insurance because of the IRMA.
Well, in most cases, it probably is. The law says that if your husband works for an employer with even 20 or more employees, that that employer has to continue offering him health insurance as long as he works, regardless of how old he is, and they have to offer it to you as well as his spouse. So in that case, you will not face any late enrollment penalties when you later decide that you need to have Medicare because his employer coverage is ending. So whether you're 67, 77, whatever it is, there's no penalty for somebody rolling off of an authorized employer group health insurance plan. Is that what you need to know?
I think mostly how do you document that so that you aren't penalized in the future?
Smart question. The employer is legally required to provide you a statement that says this person has had continuous health care coverage at X company from this date through this date. So that you should get, whether it's digital, I don't think it's a piece of paper, but you should get a document that basically is an official document from the employer that certifies you've had qualifying health coverage.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Jean in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. My husband was, we are going to Mayo Clinic for the past 10 plus years to receive a scan that they and only they have at the Rochester location. We changed to a Medicare Advantage plan and were shocked that even though Medicare covers this C11 choline PET scan, under the Medicare Advantage plan, we were not eligible. So we went through the appeal process, and they use Maximus, which rubber-stamped the decision to deny coverage of the scan. And I just wanted to comment that the appeal process is a sham because, I mean, they're outsourcing that to Maximus. And we've contacted Tammy Baldwin, and they assured us that their office is aware of this issue with the Medicare Advantage plan, and they're on top of it. So that's just my two cents.
All right.
It's, you know, the appeals process is overseen by the foxes in the hen house. That's true for the earlier stages. The later stages, and there are five appeal stages, and, you know, I'd need a separate user guide just to explain them all because they're just mine. But the fact is, yeah, it's stacked against consumers. The process is very hard for consumers to successfully navigate and win.
Yeah. Jean, thank you. Mary in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to share an experience I had talking about Medicare Advantage as them being somewhat predatory also. I'm a guardian for my brother. He was mentally disabled. He is 65. I am not. So I'm kind of muddling through everything. He was getting phone calls this spring, left and right. And I told him, do not tell anybody anything. Don't say yes to anything. Well, lo and behold, he went to see his doctor a couple of weeks ago. And they said, sorry, we can't take you anymore. You have Medicare Advantage. He called me in a panic. And he said, I didn't sign up for it. Well, he must have said yes at one point to somebody. So I called Medicare right away. They were so helpful, and they were able to get him back on traditional Medicare by saying that it was a misrepresentation. So I wanted to just share that, you know, they did. They were good. They stood by and helped me out.
Some good news
that's
there.
That's a good story to hear because you know, there are cases when people can do the right thing for the right reasons. And I'm sorry your brother got taken advantage of. But that's another little sort of segue for me. Medicare Advantage plans have really been criticized for overly aggressive marketing. And I said before that the Medicare regulators have sort of tilted towards Medicare Advantage plans because they support the concept of managed care as a way to restrained drug or price increases. But they also finally have come down on these plans and said, your sales tactics are way too aggressive. And it's going to be interesting to see during this open enrollment period that begins today, whether or not the plans back off from some of their aggressive sales tactics, and also whether the private insurance brokers who sell these plans aggressively, whether they also tone down their act a bit. All I can say is I urge your listeners to complain loud and often if they feel they're poorly treated in the sales process because people need to know this. So I mentioned SHIP before. You know, call SHIP, file a complaint, say, please tell people that this plan ABC is not doing right by me, or call 1-800-MEDICARE and complain on the Medicare hotline.
Phil, thank you so much. Philip Moeller's book, you should get a copy, take a look at it. It's revised and updated, Get What's Yours for Medicare. Maximize your coverage, minimize your costs. I'm Larry Mueller.
My old desk never needs a rest. I've never once heard it cry.
Ah, a little song titled Good Old Desk to get us in the mood to talk about old furniture and, as a matter of fact, antique furniture. We're going to talk about antique furniture restoration on the show today with our guest, Dennis Hirons. With us for the hour, he's an antique furniture restorer, operates a full-time repair shop. It's called The Hardwood Craftsman. And he's located in Middleton, Wisconsin, just outside of Madison. Been working with wood for more than 50 years. And Dennis has some history about how furniture's been manufactured over the years. And as we talk with him, certainly want to hear from you. Tell us about the antique furniture restoration project that you're proud of. Or have you picked up an old dresser or chair and you want to know what to do next? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dennis Hirons, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Larry.
How'd you get into antique restoration?
Well, I was a rough carpenter in college, so I had been woodworking since at least then, and just did it, you know, in my spare time over the years, and it became a really obsessive hobby. And then about 5 years ago, I started this business full time.
Oh, man. And just to clarify, there's furniture restoration and furniture conservation. What's the difference between the restoration and the conservation?
Sure. Restoration is when you want to get a piece back into usable condition. So you have an old chair and the leg is broken and you want to repair it in such a way that it can be used, where conservation would be more like museum work, where they want to conserve the original piece, even if it's not usable as a chair anymore, but they want to maintain that original finish, original structure.
All right. That makes sense. Qualifies in your mind as antique furniture?
Well, technically, an antique is anything that's 100 years old or older. So basically, stuff that was built in, you know, 1925 and earlier is considered an antique at this point.
Okay. And you have said that generally, antique furniture is better than modern furniture, and you have several reasons why. The first is cost, but talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I may be a little biased in this respect, but I always think that you're better off buying antique furniture over any of the fast furniture that's mass-produced today. Yeah, cost is the biggest thing, or the first thing that comes to mind. When you buy a new piece of furniture, it's like buying a car. It loses its value right away. And you're never going to get that back, typically. Where an old antique piece, especially if you take care of it and keep it in good working order, is going to maintain a lot of its value. Sometimes it might even go up in value, depending on the piece itself.
And antique furniture can be more durable, can it not, than the modern furniture? I'm thinking about the wood that might have been used, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. So back 100 years ago and earlier, they used almost exclusively solid wood. And solid wood, I think, is the best way to build a piece of furniture. You can use really strong, time-tested joinery in it, dovetails and mortise and tenon joints, where newer furniture is not, in my opinion, newer furniture is not produced or not designed to be durable. It's designed to be easily manufactured, easy to ship, or easy for a customer to put together, which does not equal durability.
For sure. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of many people who would like to talk to you, so let's take some calls. Mark in Fort Atkinson, we go to you first. Hi, Mark.
Hello. How are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know clocks and old phonographs are in the category of old furniture, but they're certainly most of them are made out of wood. And also another thing they have in common is the use of shellac as a finish. So I'm here to extol the virtues of shellac as a finish.
Ah, so what do you think about shellac, Dennis?
Outstanding. That is my primary finish as well. Shellac is what most antiques were finished in until really the 20th century.
And what's good about that shellac?
Well, shellac is a natural. It's a natural substance. It's actually made from the excretions of the lac bug, which are dried out, and then you add pure alcohol to it, and that becomes your finish. You spread the finish out over your piece of furniture or your clock, your record player, and the alcohol evaporates away, and the shellac finish is left behind. It's not the most durable finish, but it's plenty durable enough for most uses. It's easily repairable. It's non-toxic. Like I said, it's made. I make shellac quite often with grain alcohol that you can buy at the liquor store.
There you go. Mark, thank you very much for calling. What about Pete in Kaukauna? What's on your mind, Pete?
Hello?
Hi, what can we do for you?
I wanted to ask a question about an old desk that I came by.
Yeah.
It was made by the Burkhart Furniture Company. It's got an inkwell in it, so it's got to be pretty old. Anyway, my question is, it is a shellac finish, and it was all crazed and everything, and I kind of repaired that part of it by just putting some more shellac over it and sort of melting it. Anyway, what I need to do is replace a shelf that goes underneath between the legs, and I don't know how to match the finish. It's a very dark, it's some sort of grain filler, and I don't know if it's stain or if the filler gives a really dark brown color. It almost looks black. I don't know if that's from age or if it was the finish itself when it was made, you know?
Yeah.
You know what kind of wood it is?
It's white oak, quarter sawn white oak.
White. Okay, beautiful. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have a piece in my shop, quarter sawn white oak, that came in and it was almost black with the finish, with the shellac on it. And that is from age. Over time, the finish itself darkens. And I was able to take that off, again, with just pure alcohol and get back to the wood. And it's amazing how much grain you can see once that dark finish is taken off. But it sounds like in your case, you didn't remove the finish, which is not necessary. It sounds like you re-amalgamated the finish by adding more alcohol and shellac to it. And that takes that crazing away. But it does leave the darker color on it. If you wanted the piece to be lighter, you'd have to strip off all of the shellac rather than just melting new stuff over it. So in order to get new white oak to look like the old stuff with a darker finish, you would need to stain that somehow.
Okay, so he could take that shellac off, that finish off first?
He could. If you wanted to strip the entire piece, you can, which sounds like a lot of effort after you've just fixed the old finish.
Yeah.
But if you did want the lighter look, you could strip it all back and then just put new shellac over it and then shellac the other piece. There's a good chance, though, that you're still going to have to color the new piece of wood because it's not going to be the same tannins and same colors as the existing furniture that was, you know, probably harvested over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And then sometimes with the shellac, historically, they would add color to the shellac itself as they're putting the shellac on. Rather than stain and then put shellac, they would add color to the shellac itself.
Pete, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Eugene and Viola will go to you. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Larry, your guest. I've got a floor model Philco radio built about 1930 or 31. And it's in pretty nice shape, but the finish on it is all dark. If I take that old finish off, that old varnish off, will I devalue the radio?
I always have trouble answering questions about value. I'm not a seller I don't deal in antique furniture from a buyer or seller perspective. So whether the value is affected is going to be a question for a dealer. People ask me that all the time. They'll bring a piece of furniture in and ask if it's worth the cost of fixing it. And what they're asking half the time is, can I sell it for what the cost of repairing it is going to be? And that I just don't know. But is it worth it for you to have a piece of a furniture or this radio in your home that's nice to look at and nice to use? That would be certainly a question that you alone could answer. But the sale value, I just don't have that experience to talk to that.
Okay. Gene, there you go. Thank you for calling. Renee in Viroqua, on to you now. Hi, Renee.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I have a piece of furniture from 1921, and that's because they wrote on the back where they bought it from. And it's a white blonde piece of furniture. The base of it is black allnut, but the top of it looks like a veneer, and it's gotten chipped. I wouldn't mind changing it out, but I don't know what I'm dealing with.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you have a black walnut base, and the top has got some kind of veneer on it.
Right. It looks like a, it's so shiny. It's white blonde, but it's really shiny. So it's
okay. And are you thinking that you wanted to replace the whole top, the whole veneer, or do you want to just repair the chips?
I think I'll go ahead and replace the whole veneer because it's quite a few chips and gouges. And
is there?
Burn marks.
Burn marks. Okay.
Well, if it was made in 1921, it almost certainly was secured down with high glue, which is an animal glue. It's basically made from the sinew and tendons of animals, and it's been used for centuries, millennia. And that's what's holding your veneer down, so you want to be able to get that up. It's going to take some... what I would typically do is take some scrapers and some steam and get up underneath there and get the veneer off as best as you can. Then you're going to have to clean the surface that's there, get all of the old glue off. And if there's, you know, cracks in the veneer, you're going to have little bits of dirt and grime that have worked its way down to that base wood. And if the base wood is in good condition, then you can get a new sheet of veneer and apply it. And I would do it with hide glue again. But there are commercially available glues that are made just for veneer where you would apply it to both sides and then press it together. That's always the biggest issue, though, with doing an entire top is that you have to get consistent pressure down across the whole top. There are some woodworking shops that use a vacuum press, and it's basically a really large Ziploc baggie that you put the either the top or the veneered piece inside of this bag, and they sucks the air out and applies a lot of even pressure to keep the veneer down. Save that, you would probably just put a solid piece of plywood over the top and load it up with weights in order to hold that down. It's not an easy task, but it's you know, that's going to give you the best result. But again, that's assuming that the base of the top is still in good shape. If that has warps or cracks in it, then you have to address that before you put the new veneer down.
Yeah, good points, Renee. Thank you very much for calling. Dennis Hirons, our guest today, antique furniture restorer. He operates a full-time repair shop in Middleton, and his business is called The Hardwood Craftsman. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today here on WPR News. Just a reminder that our book club program is coming up later this month. We're reading the book titled When I'm Dead. It's When I'm Dead, written by Hannah Morrissey. It's a dark, a fast-paced mystery, and it's set right here in Wisconsin. Love to have you read along and join in the show. The date of the show is October 24th. Right now, we're looking at antique furniture restoration with Dennis Hirons. His business is called the Hardwood Craftsman. He operates a full-time repair shop in Middleton. And join in. Questions, the number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. JB in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, JB.
Greetings. I have a dining room set that my spousal unit's grandparents purchased in 1899 when they got married. The dining room set is in exceptional condition, and I am in the process of reupholstering the seats on the thing with needlepoint. Keep in mind that there are 10 chairs and there are 50,000 stitches in each of those needlepoints. So it's been a several years project. The chair seats, the seat portion themselves is a square frame with webbing stretched across it. And I am replacing the webbing. However, some of the side, some of the rails on this, the sides on it, when you go to tack the webbing into it, they just split.
So they're dried out and splitting. So what can you do in that circumstance, JB?
At all, what can be done for something like that besides having all new seat frames made?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that is a problem with the webbing a lot of times, especially if it's been reupholstered multiple times. Every time it gets reupholstered, new nails and tacks and staples are put into there, and it just completely perforates that piece of wood. The only thing that I would be able to do with that would be to add additional wood underneath the seat that the webbing would be attached to. In fact, I've repaired chairs sometimes that have had multiple layers of new wood because the old one just keeps getting more perforated. It's not going to be an easy task because you're either – it may be as simple as putting new timber underneath the chair, but you may actually have to cut out some of the old wood first and then glue new stuff in. It can be quite a long process, but it sounds like it's going to be worth the effort with all the time you're spending on the needlework and the upholstery.
Yeah.
It sounds like it would definitely be worth it.
Yeah, that's one of those. Is that the kind of job that you get sometimes, Dennis?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes people bring those in.
They're working. JB is kind of working on the seats, but this might be something that she might say, you know what, I should see Dennis or somebody else to do that part of the work, which would make then my life easier.
Sure. I mean, it's not complicated. It's something it can certainly be done. In fact, I would sooner have a customer do that work to the chair than Renee from Barocco's work on the installing a new veneer top on a table. That one's going to be a little bit more complicated than the chair work. It's going to take a while to do the chairs.
Yeah.
Okay. But it sounds like it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, it does indeed. JB, thank you for calling. Let's go to Jeff in Berry Mills next. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I had two things. One was I was wondering how much tongue oil was used as a finish for wood years ago.
That's a good question. I don't know about the history of tongue oil. Tongue oil is one of those products that I typically avoid only because different manufacturers make it in completely different ways. So just because something says tongue oil in the hardware store doesn't mean that it's the same that you get at a different place that sells it. So I don't know what the history of tongue oil is. Oils have been used for centuries, though, to protect the wood. And any kind of oil, tongue oil or linseed oil, is going to soak down into the wood and give some protection from within the wood. Not very much protection on top of the surface, though.
Got it. Thank you, Jeff, for calling. Well, let's talk a little about the history of some of this. In the first place, what kind of wood has typically been used in older furniture?
It really depends on the area. here in the States, we use a lot of oak furniture, cherry, walnut. In Europe, they use different species depending on what's locally available. Usually, mahogany is a species that's been used for a while in beautiful furniture. But that's typically an exotic that would be shipped in and used sparingly. But I would say most of the furniture that comes into my shop is going to be oak, cherry, walnut, or mahogany, one of those four.
And what did people use for glue back in the day?
For glue, it would have been this animal glue, this hide glue. And that's, I think it's an outstanding glue. Again, it's made with parts of animals left over. And it is, it's great for a number of reasons. It's historically proven. Again, it's been used for thousands of years. It's strong. It's readily available. You can buy it in the hardware store either in liquid form, or you can buy it in ground up granules that you rehydrate yourself. You typically have to use it warm because it gets pretty thick and solid at room temperature. But it's reversible. That's the big thing, is that when you glue up a joint, you can get that glue apart by just adding a little bit of either moisture and or heat to it and separate it. And that's important because furniture, especially chairs, chairs are the one piece of furniture that you typically daily put, you know, 150, 200 or more pounds on and shift around back and forth constantly. You don't do that with desks or tables typically, but chairs take a lot of abuse. And if those joints aren't allowed a little bit of flexibility, they will break. The unfortunate thing I see is that when people do antique repairs, and if there's one thing I can get across to the audience today is don't use regular wood glue or epoxy or polyurethane glue on your repairs. Only use hide glue because you can get that apart and redo the chair.
Yeah, and it's going to give a little bit, or?
It will. It'll give a little bit, and over time it'll eventually release. Where modern glues, which were developed in the 40s, 50s on, PVA glue, wood glue, those hold so strong. They are better at gluing things, the modern glues, but they're much stronger than the wood. So if there's too much pressure put on it, it's going to break the wood. Where with hide glue, it's about the same strength as the wood itself. So when pressure is put on a joint with hide glue, the joint will release rather than break most of the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Stephen Madison wondered, what's the difference between shellac and varnish, and which do you recommend?
Well, shellac and varnish are different. Again, shellac is made with alcohol and lac bug secretions that are amalgamated and put on the top of a piece of furniture. So it's a protectant that goes on top of the wood. Varnish is usually a mixture of oil and some other substance. Historically, that would have been wax. So when you put an oil and wax mixture on a piece of wood, it soaks into the wood and protects from underneath. So it depends on what you're trying to do. The varnish is going to be a little more protective, probably, of water sitting on the surface of the wood, because it won't let the water penetrate in, where shellac is going to be better at abrasion resistance, because it's actually a layer on top of the wood. The problem with shellac is that if you let water sit on it, it will create water rings. It'll penetrate the finish. And if you put alcohol, because it's made with alcohol, if you spill your scotch on it, it will take that shellac right off. So what do I recommend? I always recommend shellac. It's a little bit more durable, and I like the look of it better than varnish. But they're both acceptable finishes, and they're both historically accurate as well.
You mentioned water stain, and I think Kim in Eau Claire has a question relating to that. Let's go there. Hi, Kim.
Hello. I've got a 150-year-old dresser that my great-grandfather made. He was from the old country, from Germany, and it has a blood stain on it. And it, unfortunately, a long time ago, a plant was put on there and water damaged the top of it. And I'm wondering, will I ever be able to match what's on there? Or that's my question.
The water stain.
Yeah. Do you know what the desk is or dresser is made out of?
Pine.
Pine. Okay. And is the watermark, is it a light color mark or is it a dark color mark?
Light.
Okay. That's good. A light colored watermark means that water has gotten into the finish and the water vapor is trapped inside the finish. A lot of times, or I should say sometimes, you can get that out without affecting the rest of the finish. The problem is if something has sat on it for a long time and actually wore through the finish down to the wood, then the wood starts to stain dark. And once the wood stains dark, you really should have to, you really should strip the entire piece and refinish it after getting the dark stains out. But if you just have water stains that are light colored on it, there's a few things that you can do. There's a few home remedies that you can try. They say that you could put mayonnaise on it, rub that in, let it sit for a few hours and then wipe it off, or vinegar and olive oil, toothpaste. Those types of things are thought to penetrate the finish and allow the water vapor to escape. I don't know that I've had any success with those, but you see those as remedies on the internet all the time. What I typically would try is an iron. If you set your iron to a medium setting with no steam and put a dry cloth over the stain and then just rub the iron over it for a few seconds and then lift the cloth up and take a look and just keep going at it like that for a bit, pausing every few seconds to look underneath and make sure you're not overheating the wood, what you'll see is that stain will slightly start to lighten. It may not all disappear, but you can get, 90% of it out, usually using that technique.
That's a really good tip. Kim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Sheila, who's on Madeline Island, has something for us. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Good morning. My question is more about floor, but using similar, the flooring has used similar wood as furniture. It's either red oak or red pine. And it has been oiled before, but it's been about 20 years. And I'm looking to re-oil it. And I'm having a difficult time finding, most of the information I find is for furniture, and I know it gets more wear than that. But wondering if Danish oil or tongue oil or what sort of oil you would recommend for redoing the floor. I don't want to varnish or polyurethane it.
Sure. So I've never used tongue oil on a floor before. Interesting enough, I build furniture as well, and I follow some of the YouTube personalities who build furniture. And what's gotten really popular in the do-it-yourself furniture community are these hard wax oil products. They're made by a bunch of different companies, and it's basically oil and wax, a formula that's been around for a long time. But these furniture makers will rub that into the furniture and use that as their protectant. And it gets a lot of gaff on it because it's not very durable to scratches. But a lot of these companies are starting to formulate it so that it offers a little more abrasion resistance. And as a matter of fact, some of the bigger brands that are used in this furniture community were actually developed for flooring applications originally. Now, it's certainly not the most durable floor that you would get. The most durable would be a polyurethane or some other modern chemical finish. But if you get one of these new hard wax oil finishes and put it on your floor, it's something that has been used for a long time. Again, it's not going to be the most scratch resistant, but it will provide some durability against spills and such. But it is a product that you will need to reapply every 1 to 2 years in order to keep that luster up. But applying it is really simple. You just pour it on the floor and rub it until it dries out and move on. And you can repair it as well. If you get a little damage to one portion of the floor, you don't have to strip the entire floor or redo the whole floor. You can just apply it in that little area.
Hmm. Huh. Sheila, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Suzanne emailed us. They're lining an old trunk from the late 50s with cedar. And Suzanne is wondering if they should seal the trunk for odor management before they apply the cedar.
Obviously, there's an odor problem to begin with there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would want to deal with that before I put new cedar in, because you don't want that odor coming through. And I guess my main concern would be is that odor mold or mildew, something that should be completely eradicated before you not only put cedar in it, but your clothes or any of your other belongings in it. So, yeah, I would definitely address that odor first.
Yeah, I think I would definitely agree with that. And let's see, how can you tell if you're overheating wood? That goes back to that earlier question that you had about the iron.
With the water rings?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if your cloth sticks to the surface of the wood, that was too hot. You've melted it right into the finish. You should be able to, when you pull the rag off, you should be able to, you know, put your hand on it and feel the warmth, but it shouldn't be so hot that it's burning your hand. It would be really hard to overheat it if you just spend 3 or 4 seconds with the iron and then lift it and continually check. If you left the iron on for, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds, then that would just be too much. It reminds me of when I went to my training, the instructor showed me a way to get rid of water rings, which I am not recommending to anyone here, but I'm just repeating it as a funny story. He created water rings in a piece of furniture and then showed me how to get rid of them by pouring meth or what we call denatured alcohol here, pour it on the water ring and light it. And the burning flames would quickly melt the shellac finish and release all the vapor. And boy, it got rid of the water ring, but not something I would want to try or certainly not recommend.
Well, here's Bobby in Middleton. You mentioned scotch earlier, a scotch ring. And Bobby in Middleton is wondering, is there a preferred scotch for winding up a long week in the shop?
Any single malt will do. I've got a shelf full of great bottles here. And if Bobby's in Middleton and he'd like to stop by at some point, he's more than welcome to.
Joe at Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I've got a couple questions. One is regarding resurfacing an old teak, antique, that old from the early 70s, maybe, teak dining table. It's currently has sort of a sticky finish to it. It's been layered over for years and years with that old English oil, and it's built up kind of a nasty feeling to it. The other question is, I've got this old 1939 Epiphone guitar amp with a beautiful wooden cabinet, and it's been through a flood, and the bottom part of the veneer has separated, sort of delaminated, as well as with the plywood. I was wondering what the best way to fix that would be, or if it's fixable at all.
Sure. So the first question, the teak dining table, a lot of the teak dining tables, nearly all of them that I've seen are a veneer product. So it's a really thin layer of teak over a substrate, a less expensive wood or plywood or MDF or something like that. Probably if it was in the 70s, it would be over MDF. So you're not going to be able to sand that off effectively because it really quickly you can go right through the veneer and lose all of that teak. So you're going to have to chemically get that old English off. I don't do any furniture stripping here unless it is shellac, which is strippable with just alcohol. But it sounds like what you're going to need is to apply a stripper to that teak dining room table to get all of the gooey old finish off first. Once you get that off, then you'll have no problem, and I would put a teak oil right back over it as a finish. Regarding the Epiphone amp, that sounds really neat.
Yeah.
If you have some veneer that's loosening up, whether it's on this amp or anything, but the veneer is still in place, it's just popped up a little bit. One quick thing that you can do is what we call hot blocking it. And that's where I take a piece of flat wood, like a chunk of MDF plywood, bigger than the loose piece of veneer, and I heat that up. I'll put it on a hot plate or hit it with a dryer or a heat gun for a while until it gets nice and warm. And then you put a piece of parchment down over the loose veneer and then the hot block on top of it and then a weight on top of that. And what that does is it transfers heat down into the veneer. And certainly if the veneer was glued down originally with high glue, but sometimes even with more modern glues, that glue will reactivate and grab that veneer piece and hold it down. So sometimes you can do that. If that doesn't work, then what you would do is just add some more glue up underneath there. So you'd want to peel up the veneer very carefully so you don't break it off and scrape out anything that's in there. You don't want any dirt or little bits of grime. And then apply some more glue. And then again, use some kind of flat block with a weight over the top of it to hold it down.
Makes good sense. Good luck, Joe. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Talking with Dennis Irons, who is an antique furniture restorer, operates a full-time repair shop in Middleton, and his business is called The Hardwood Craftsman. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at restoring antique furniture with our guest who does a lot of it, Dennis Irons. His business is called The Hardwood Craftsman, works out of Middleton. It's great to have him with us. Stuart in Tolkien Creek has a question for you. Let's go there.
Good afternoon. It's not an antique. It's a 25-year-old Amish-made oak table with six chairs. The end chairs have arms on them. But the other four chairs, over time of sliding in and out from the table, have the seats become loose from the backrest, which is the back legs also. I tried tightening them up a couple years ago, but I figured out that the screws are glued in. So they're not horrible yet, but what do you do about that when you can't turn screws in any farther because they're glued in? I'm assuming they did not use hide glue.
Yeah, they might not have. Yeah, you're certainly going to need to get that screw loosened up and out of there. A couple different ways you can do that. I've applied heat to just the screw itself with a soldering iron, and that can sometimes loosen it up without affecting the wood around it. Something that's fairly simple that is counterintuitive is try tightening the screw a little bit first, and that may give it just enough movement to loosen it up and allow you to back it out. But you definitely want to get that screw out and get that chair tightened up, because the more you move around on it, the more the joints are being abraded. And the screw itself is going to abrade those joints. So you definitely want to take care of that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, a couple of good tips, though. Stuart, thank you for calling. Keith in Lake Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind, Keith?
Yes, Larry. We have about a 30-year-old solid cherry stickly bedroom set with a hand-rubbed finish, not a lacquer finish or varnish, but just a hand-rubbed oil. And we were told to put furniture wax on it, and we're really not happy with that. What would you recommend in terms of cleaning it, and then what should we use? Lemon oil, or is there anything we should be using on this furniture?
Well, if it gets dirty, certainly just water, but there should be no reason to regularly clean a piece of furniture. I think people use too much of the furniture waxes and cleaners just to try to keep that that luster looking well. If you say it's a hand rub finish, typically what that is some kind of finish like shellac or sometimes lacquer. And the hand rubbing is taking something abrasive like steel wool and then a lubricant. Wool lube is one of the lubricants that I use. Murphy's oil soap is an option for that. And you basically rub the furniture in the direction of the grain with the steel wool, lubricated steel wool, and that really gives the furniture a nice luster. If your furniture is starting to lose the luster, then maybe that's what you need to do is have it rubbed again. But you shouldn't really have to clean it or apply anything to keep the finish looking nice.
Yeah. Keith, there you go. Thank you for calling. Ron in Land O'Lakes, on to you. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Yeah, a quick question. As I collect more antiques through garage sales and whatnot, antique furniture, I should say, what's your advice on how to learn how to restore antique furniture, the woodworking part and all the chemicals and things like that? I've Googled a lot of it. There's so many different sites. Is there any woodworking classes that you're aware of up in the Northwoods or any websites that you would recommend to start learning how to do what you do?
Well, it's a great question. There are, I think, a lot of people that do antique restoration either as hobbies or as kind of a part-time business that have learned from YouTube or just kind of figuring it out being woodworkers. But there's very few formal training classes. In fact, I looked and looked and looked and couldn't find anything here other than a quick weekend class for the do-it-yourselfer. So I ended up going to England where they have obviously much older furniture, but a bunch of schools in antique restoration. And so I picked one there and signed up, and I've actually gone twice to schools in England to learn just because I can't find much here. If you're looking for a quick class, like a weekend, I think you can probably find that. There's a school called Mark Adams School of Woodworking in Indiana. They might do a week-long class on either restoration or antique finishes that would be helpful for you. But in the classes that I attended, the very first thing that you have to know is how to build a piece of furniture before you can repair it, because most of the time you're taking this furniture apart and rebuilding certain parts of it before you put it back together. So having a good, solid basis in furniture making is the first start. And then you can always, there's a couple organizations here. One is called the Society for American Period Furniture Makers. And that's a group of people that are interested in building furniture, historically accurate furniture. They sometimes have resources on training. And then the one that I belong to, in addition to the first one I mentioned, I also belong to the British Antique Furniture Restorers Association, BAFRA, BAFRA.co.uk, I believe. And they have a resource online talking about classes that they're aware of. And that's actually how I found the one in England.
Hmm. There you go, Ron. Thank you for calling. And David in New Richmond, on to you. Hi, David.
Hey, Larry. My father was a pretty well-known antique dealer in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, particularly for his primitive furniture and also colonial furniture. He had a secret for cleaning furniture that he stumbled upon that he actually repackaged in baby food jars and sold to people because they always asked, how do you get your furniture to look like this? So now that he's gone, I'm going to share it with everybody. It was Gojo hand cleaner. believe it or not, try it on any piece of furniture that you want to really bring out the wood grain and shine. You will be amazed.
Gojo hand cleaner. Boy, I haven't used that in many a year. What do you think, Dennis?
I've never used that for furniture, but I don't see why it wouldn't work. I mean, it's a cleaner, a degreaser for your hands. just not knowing what's in it, I don't know that I could recommend it, but it sounds like it was successful for David's father.
Yeah, it sure does. You might try it on a little piece or something just to see.
Sure, test it. It reminds me, too, the person asked the question about cleaning. There is a general cleaning solution that I make up for just getting some of the old grime off of furniture. And I got this out of a book by Will Kirk, who is a famous restorer over in England. It's one part linseed oil to three parts MEPS denatured alcohol is what it's called here. Three parts denatured alcohol and three parts mineral spirits. So one part linseed oil, three parts denatured alcohol, three parts mineral spirits. You shake it up until it becomes like a milky consistency, and then you just spread it on your piece, and it should take a lot of that grease and grime off while adding a little bit of moisture to the wood.
I wonder if it would help Renee in Egg Harbor. They have an old round wood table with a paper cardboard-like circle insert on the top. They want to repair it or replace it or refinish it because it's stained.
Wow, a paper cardboard insert. On a table?
Well, it's with a paper cardboard-like insert.
Oh, okay. Boy, it's really...
it's hard to imagine.
What that might be, but yeah, exactly. It might be a leather that's just really dried out. It might be paper or cardboard. I've seen that in chairs before. It's not paper. It's more of a really thin wood. But yeah, without seeing it, I'm not really sure. But I would think that this cleaner would not adversely affect that.
Yeah, I would give that a. I think I would give that a try. Or Gojo, you give that a try.
Gojo, yeah.
it's actually, you know, you mentioned leather. It could possibly be leather.
It might, yeah.
Yeah, that could make some sense. Well. At any rate, that's what we got for you, Renee. Thank you so much for calling. you do about 95% of your work with hand tools. What's in your toolbox?
Old hand planes and chisels and hand saws. And that's what really got me into this is using these antique tools is really fun. But when you're going to repair a chair, you can't take the chair to the table saw. You're just not going to be able to make cuts there. So you have to know how to use hand tools. You bring the tool to the piece itself. So I really enjoy it. I've been using them for years. I'm actually teaching a class this weekend here in Madison on how to use hand tools and how to sharpen them up. But that's a really fun hobby in itself.
Yeah, it sounds
great. I love using old hand tools.
Is your class all filled?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you have a web. What's your website?
It's hardwoodcraftsman.com.
Hardwoodcraftsman.com. That's
correct. Craftsman is singular. M-A-N.
M-A-N. So, and one word, obviously. Hardwoodcraftsman.com. I want to make sure I got
correct.
That right. Dennis, it has been a real joy to have you with us today. I hope we can do this again down the road. Thank you so much for spending
Thank you
time.
Very much, Larry.
Been a lot.
And you're certainly welcome, or any of the listeners are welcome to stop in my shop anytime and just say hi.
All right. Dennis Hirons, his business located in Middleton, it's called The Hardwood Craftsman. And he's given us a lot of really good information today on restoring furniture. Thanks for joining us today, and this and all our shows, of course, a team effort. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our producers, our technical directors, our Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau, and I'm Larry Mueller, and I am here to tell you there's lots more in store right through the afternoon, so I hope you stay with us right here on WPR News.
Say a word, but it's perfect.